Now, both of them worship the moon. These dogs have been used to symbolize that which worships phasic behavior and is dominated by the moon. The moon in the Sanskrit form guna, which means mood or modal activity, is also the word from which the word guna, woman, is derived. So it is peculiar to the Khan of phasic females from this inconstancy of the affective life that is not in contact with the infinite spirit. Every change of mood in a human being can be said to be moon dominated in this sense. And the dog tame and wild are baying at this because they don't understand it. When a wolf bays at the moon, he can't help it. But somehow this great light seems to be terribly important. And we're human beings, and therefore we are like Christ, each one of us a pantherian, that is a pantechnicon of animals. We have all animals within us, and we can find, if we look at the moon, an echo in ourselves of dogs, wild and tame. We actually feel the moon as a peculiar influence. It seems very strange. We say that it has a baleful effect, or that it has a beautiful effect, according to whether our love life is going well or ill. Coming out of the water on this card of the moon is a crayfish, and this symbolizes the emerging from the depths of the unconscious, and in the water, the non-individuated unconscious, what Carl Jung would call the collective unconscious. From this unconscious, conjured up by the pull of the phasic behavior, emerges the threat of the formless horror from below. This means that inside every man, when he is suffering from the mood, when his moods are elated and depressed by whether things are going well or ill, there emerges from below, from the depths, some strange forebodings, threats, so that when things are going well, there's a little shadow that overshadows them and threatens the removal of these things. And when things are going bad, the shadow that comes on says, I told you so. I told you it was going to go wrong. So when the thing is bad, you feel, yes, this is correct, this is bad. And when it's good, you think this is not possible to continue, so it must become bad. So that as long as you're subject to this phasic behavior, the change of mood, so long will you be dominated in the same way that this wild dog and tame dog and this crayfish are subjected. And in the same card, there are two stone pillars, and these pillars signify, like the pillars of Hercules, the gateway to the beyond. And these creatures dare not go through those pillars, any more than the ancient peoples living in the Mediterranean dare sail to the Straits of Gibraltar to see what was beyond. We know that the ancient Britons somehow managed to get through. But to the Mediterranean peoples, actually to dare to sail through the Straits of Gib into the great ocean beyond was unthinkable. Very, very few people dared to do it. And these two stone columns signify the pillars of Hercules on the Straits of Gibraltar, or the outer limit and polarity of the finite. And those beings subject to phasic behavior dare not go beyond that which is definable. Beyond the Mediterranean, the middle of the earth ocean, there is an Atlantic Ocean. There is a terrible eating, weaving force. At the Edomite kings, there is an infinite force that will slowly take you to pieces. There is a nameless monster beyond, and in the name of this monster, it is best for us not to go beyond the definition. The hermit who understands the meaning of this card and who it was who set up the pillars to mark the lines beyond which we must not go is ready to pass into the significance of the next card, which, being vertically below the Hierophant and the Hanged Man, naturally must express itself in this kind of significance. The Hierophant represents the articulated version of the eternal mother or Sophic sphere, and the Hierophant has no power over the hanged man, because the hanged man has become his own Hierophant, and having become so and carried on to his next stage of development, he has come to the call of the sun. Now you know that the sun signifies heat and light. On this card, straight lines and wavy lines. The straight ones are the light and the wavy ones are the heat. The straight ones correspond with your intellectual or structured mind, and the wavy ones to the volitional and affective processes. The sun gives forth heat and light, gives forth form and power. And in this card, the Hierophant self-realized at the psychic level as the hanged man, the man who is his own high priest, now appears as a naked little boy on a white horse. He is now innocence personified. He is getting remarkably close to the supreme image of the pool. He's now become a child. Except ye become a little child, ye shall not enter into the kingdom of heaven. Here symbolizes the world. So this innocent little boy, he's riding without reins on a white horse. A horse symbolizes that Horatio, or power ratio of being on a first white horse, signifies this in perfect balance. And he is going forth flying a red standard. Red means, of course, activity. And he's not flying a blue standard for thought. He's just going out doing things, riding on his equilibrated power, knowing the meaning of the Hierophant and the hanged man. He has now become an innocent who is riding about without reins. He's not guiding his horse. He is going where his horse takes him. But his horse is his equilibrated balance of power. This means to say that he is now completely ready for the last judgment in the gross material world. Just as the hanged man was ready for the psychic death, so likewise, this innocent boy riding the horse in the sun card is ready for the gross material death. He has begun to understand why it is that his red flag appears as a red cross on the banner of the trumpet which the angel is blowing. The angel is blowing this trumpet, and emerging from the tombs are all the dead, and they are going to be judged. Christ says, every man goes into his own place, and his works follow him. It is appointed to man once to die, and after that the judgment. He understands the meaning of this judgment card. If you have hanged yourself adequately on the infinite, you have already escaped the judgment. And therefore, you can operate like the innocent boy on the horse. And the last judgment must come, that is to say, once the temporal process has started, there are certain necessary developments. If we go back to the beginnings of art in the caves and look at the way this art has given birth to subsequent arts, and we go back to primitive science and look how that primitive science has grown into modern science, and we go back into primitive philosophy and primitive religion and see how they have grown, we see that there is a natural term of all the activities of the human race, just as there would be a natural term if we inserted into a closed sphere a lot of moving particles. These moving particles would move about until they had distributed themselves equably. They would then have attained what we call maximum entropy, and they would then go into the judgment state. They are equilibrated. Each little particle is now in its own place, and this is the consummation of days, or the final adding up of all the activities of the temporal process in the Last Judgment. Now, if one gets through the Last Judgment, then, having been aware that one is a magician who precipitated this world, having fought through the chariot and the hermit and the hanged man, having paid back into the eternal, what one borrowed from it, having realized one's innocence as a child, and therefore gone over the judgment, one gains the whole world without losing oneself. But the card called the world, here number 21, presents us with a funny problem in tradition. There are 22 cards here, and there are 22 letters in the Hebrew alphabet, and they are said to be in correspondence. And the scholars have always had very, very great difficulty with the card of the fool. The card of the fool is said traditionally to be in the 21st place, but it is not numbered 21, it is numbered 0. If we put the world in the 21st place, we find it's made of 3 sevens, which of course means the whole balance, the resting point on the three planes of being, the cognitive, affective and ideational levels. This world is a threefold, a trinity world of power, of feeling and of formulations or ideas. It is number 21 correctly here because of the numerical symbology, and yet that place is the one traditionally allotted to the fool. If we place the fool in this 21st place and then read the world card after it, a funny thing will happen. The last letter in the Hebrew alphabet is tau or tau, according to whether you're Spanish or German. And this tau letter symbolizes a cross or the sign of the cross, and the world is then seen simply as the crossing of the absolute powers of the magician. So that the world, as such, is actually the objectified absolute. And in this sense, this world does not correspond simply with the material world that we live in, nor with the material universe of planets, of the sun, of solar systems, of sidereal systems, whatever is visible to us. And the totality of all visibles is an infinitely small amount of what is signified by this card, the world. This world is represented here by a woman who is nude except for a peculiar flying drapery. The drapery is flying to symbolize that it is the spirit. That it is the world signifies that it is formulated. That it is a woman signifies that it is a will to formulate. This is the Shakti in the Indian philosophy. The power of the Absolute, which has now objectified itself as the world. But this world is transcendent of the material worlds that we know. It is the world Absolute, internal to which the world as we know it, the subtle world and the gross material world, subsist. So although we say here that the Absolute has objectified itself as the world, this is not pantheism, because by this world, signified in this card, we do not refer to the so-called world of material nature, but to the actual power of the Absolute insofar as by its own self-contradictory motions it establishes the mesh of form. If we then place the world on the tau, or cross, we have placed the world on the point 21 where the fool should be. The 22nd letter is the top, so why should we attribute the significance of the 22nd card to the world? Well, let us see why. The fool signifies he who has completed his evolution. He has become aware that he is the Absolute. He knows the cosmic, the macrocosmic sphere of wisdom. He understands how she precipitated into the time process historically as the first mother, the temporal empress. He understands why the deficiencies of her processes at the intellectual level, through the bias on her feeling, made her inarticulate. He therefore understands why the male, the emperor, usurped her authority by clear articulation. He understands why that emperor erected the Hierophant to talk about the Eternal Mother, to displace the authority from the temporal mother, he understands and connives with the hierophant to make sex relations permissible only by permission. He also understands why the mysterious bastard, the illegitimate Christ to be, must oppose the powers temporal, because he is born out of them and understands what they are. He understands the meaning of the infinite application of power, the indetectable application of power. He understands what it means that the hermit is old and carries within a lamp in broad daylight a little individual light to find the truth. He understands the wheel of fortune to be driven by apes and wolves, by self-advertisers and subtle beings, and he understands what the Sphinx is doing there and rejects this position for himself. He understands cosmic justice, the self-objectification of desire, the self-exposure of power once objectified. He understands and affirms the position of the hanged man as an upside-down volitional man who refuses to operate his own life from temporal considerations. He understands the principle of death and how everything temporal, every authority, even the powers of the emperor and the hierophant, must bend before this fact of the possibility of the psychic death by definitions which will precipitate itself into the gross world as the last judgment. He understands the method of reciprocal self-feeding of idea and will. He understands that the gross material world interprets the absolute infinite God as the devil, because the infinite threatens its finite purpose. He understands the babbling tower of confusion and why it must be overthrown by the inherent nature of the temporal definition. He comprehends why it is necessary to return to infinity everything that came out of it in order to keep the door of one's being open. He knows the meaning of the pillars of Hercules and that they are there not to tell you to go no further, but to tell you where the definition finishes, so that you can, if you are so willed, go beyond the definition into the infinite of Atlantis. He knows the new innocence of the child who is riding on this horse and who is the embodiment of the sun, which symbolizes the unified power of the absolute expressed as Lord of the time process. He knows the last judgment, and he knows the world. He knows all these things, and therefore, in a very peculiar sense, the fool is the world. So that we can place the fool and the world, both of them, in the 21st place. And we can lock to these two, either the 21st or the 22nd letter. Now, the 21st letter is the letter Shin, which, if you remember, we have represented as a trident. In some cards, continental cards, this is sometimes called furka, for the fool, the fork, the trident. Now, this fool understands the meaning of this letter. We've said before that this letter, Shin, the Hebrew letter, if it is pointed on the right-hand arm, the sinister one heraldically, it is pronounced Shin. And if we point it on the left hand arm, heraldically the dexter side, then it is Sin. So exactly the same letter pointed on one side is Shin or good or shine, and on the other side is bad, Sin or private aim. But the whole letter signifies fire. This letter Shin signifies fire. And this fire is this absolute energy of the magician, the energy of the magician which objectifies as the world. I think I said energy or something. I left out the half G because it shouldn't be there. Now, this absolute energy used symbolically by Heraclitus as fire is also the energy which formulates as logos, as cosmic wisdom. And it is also the same thing that appears in the gross material world as matter. So there is no difference, essentially, between a gross material particle and the will of God to self-objectification. And the fool understands this. He knows that this material world is spiritual right through. And he also knows that all definitions are self-objectifications of sentient power which has no compulsion so to objectify, and he knows it has the power to scrub out all the definitions it has made, and therefore in no sense is he limited by the definitions which he finds within the temporal gross world. He does not accept these definitions, and therefore when we look at his card we find that this young man is represented as a youth. This is the eternal youth, and he's walking over the edge of a cliff, and the edge of this cliff is the same thing as the Pillars of Hercules. He is sailing out of the Mediterranean and he just doesn't care. Whatever definition you give him, he says that is a definition. If you have given it to me, you're either reacting mechanically because someone has inserted the definition into you, or if you're not reacting mechanically, then you are willing to give me this definition. And it is your will I am concerned with, not your definition. Either the thing is mechanical or it is volitional. And if it is volitional, I too am a will. And I will make another definition. Unless your definition suits my purpose. So the fool is the supreme prince of indefinition. Indefinition negatively, not definition. And indefinition positively, indefinition. Inner defining power. This definition is the same thing as definition or divine nature. So this fool is the same card as the magician, only he has completed the process. All the power of the Father is put into the hands of the Son. This is the New Testament. The Father puts all his power into the hands of the Son. The magician, Allah, places all his power into the hands of the supreme master of indefinition, who appears as the fool. So that this fool and this world, from the point of view of the fool, are not different. The fool, called the mystic fool, as opposed to the congenital idiot in the time process, this mystic fool knows that he is the world. And he also knows that if there is any other will, if there is any validity whatever in all the other beings presented within consciousness alongside with the body which he uses as sense of reference, if there is any validity in them, it must be of the same order that he has, and it must be ultimately entirely arbitrary what they define. He honors their definition because he honors his own definition, and in honoring his own definition he is released from their definition while still honoring it. Outline of the Tarotish symbol. We'll go back over them and consider the relation between the three planes of being. We touched upon the fact that we've arranged them in three sevens. We've left the fool out as being the divine prince of indefinition. And the top row, we said, refer to the causal level, the middle one to the subtle level, and the bottom row to the gross material level. The causal level is the same thing as spirit and signifies the sentient power viewed in that aspect of consciousness, the sentience, and cause, the power. When we talk about sentient power, we're using the least number of concepts we need to explain all the phenomena of the universe. When we talk about power as ultimate cause on its own, we are dealing with the universe scientifically and excluding the observer from the universe. Science aims to be objective, by which it means to establish things in such a way that whatever they say must have what they call objective truth. Unfortunately, most materialist scientists have not bothered to define what they mean by objective in sufficiently clear terms to let them realize that the objective truth cannot be the whole truth. When we have written the word object before, we have indicated that it's from two words, one meaning to throw, eject word, and the other word meaning an orb or a sphere of being. An object is a sphere of being thrown into space. So if we imagine that space is contracting onto a center, it is contracting on itself. Imagine the infinite space is a field of power. This field of power, called by Einstein the unifield, condenses itself and produces at its point of condensation a sphere. If we like to think of this sphere as very, very small, we can call it the jot that Christ refers to, the jot or tittle that shall not pass away till all be fulfilled. If we contract the sphere down to a very, very tiny size, we can just represent it with a dot. The Hebrew letter, which looks like a dot, is called yod, and is the same as the English word jot, the Greek iota. It is said to represent the hand of God, or creative power of God, because the universe is posited, that is to say, the power is made to sit, ST, which is the basis of sit and stand, the base star, ST, and sit, ST, both mean to occupy the zone or locus in the infinite and to establish in that fact a point of reference. Now, if we realize that an existential point must be a sphere, that is to say, it must occupy a definite, finite amount of space and have a limiting factor to demark it, in other words, a perimeter. And we know that the unifield of power is not itself matter, it is force. Then the contraction or contraction of this field force produces, in the act of contraction, condensation. The condensed zone of space, and space is power, basically, is a so-called material particle. The zone of condensation is represented by the lowest septenary of the cards. But the power that produces that sphere, that contraction zone, is represented by the top septenary. So if we write the sign of Jupiter for the top level, we can write the sign of Saturn for the bottom level. Saturn means the contractive force that brings particles into existence. If we take a very tiny particle like an electron, we're dealing with a minute sphere of force. It is kept in being simply by the contraction of the field force represented by Jupiter. Now, the statement diabolos est Jus inversus, the devil is God inverted, simply means that this zone of material compaction is this field force which is called God the Father. God the Father is the free field force. God the devil is the same field force contractive upon itself to produce a center. There is no devil other than God, contracted. And there is no God other than the devil released. The field itself must be viewed as something that embraces both of these concepts, expansion and contraction. So if we say, let us mark the top line here, the causal line, with the sign of Jupiter, or the expanded field, and the bottom line with the sign of Saturn, the gross material world, or contraction or contractive force, then the middle line must be represented by the sign of Mercury. Mercury is the sign of the Messiah. If we go over to Chinese symbolism, we'll call the top line heaven, the bottom line earth, and the middle line man. In the Gospel of Matthew, when it is talking about the Son of Man and what the Son of Man can do, it appears that the Son of Man, when he has reached his optimum, can do anything because he has realized the identity of the causal and gross worlds. He knows that the material world is simply the world of force contracted. And he knows that the force world is the same world that is called material, only uncontracted. All magical precipitations, all acts of will, consist in recognizing that in the free state of the causal field is the potential of the bound or precipitated state of the effect or ex-fact gross material world. Now the middle line corresponds with the soul or psyche. So we have to say that Mercury can represent the man, as in the Gospel of Matthew, that this man, when he's raised to his optimum, can fuse together the apparent opposition between God and the devil, that is, between free and domed energy. The free force and the domed energy are none different. It is only a mode of behavior that determines whether the thing shall be called material or spiritual. If the energy goes round in circles, as in the word of, then it is called material. If the same energy just translates, then it is called spiritual. The glyph of the serpent running in the word an or anna represents spirit. The oldest glyph we have for spirit is a snake running along. And the oldest one for the time process is a snake with its tail in its mouth. It is the same snake. In another aspect of it, we've said that the Hebrew letter, the trident, or furka, the fork, corresponding with the card of the fool, is that which can stress at will, either on the right or the left. If it stresses on the right side, then it is spiritual power. If it stresses on the left side, it is material body. If it stresses on the left side, as material body, it is pronounced sin. But sin only means finite aim. There is no moral concept behind the word sin to the ancients. Sin is finite aim. A finite aim is a limited or privated aim or private aim. Now the word aim, A-I-M, tells you that the absolute, the A, has positive a point in the I, which again is the job, within the substantial field. So to have an aim is to posit a definite amount of energy and to substantiate that energy in some form. Now if we go in the opposite direction to aim, we go Mia, we are going from the substantial precipitated object through the formal content, the idea that generated this substance, to the absolute causal will which precipitated the idea. So we could write A on the top line, I in the middle line, and M on the bottom line. This would be the word aim. This word aim is another anagram of Maya, illusion. This Maya, this affirmation of the material, is all the illusion there is. If we did not posit finite aims, we could never become identified. When we become identified with the finite, if we persist in it, we develop what we call inertia. Inertia means we have affirmed work within that form. The amount of will we put into it determines how much energy is involved in the form we make. And as it takes exactly the same amount of energy to undo a form that it takes to create it, if we spend several years creating a form or fulfilling an aim, the amount of energy we have put into the fulfillment of that aim will be very high. And if we decide then that the aim has been wrong, we've misconceived it. When we have seen that we have misconceived it intellectually, this does not mean that we can put it down immediately. The amount of energy involved in generating this aim is still in it. Maybe through lack of proper logical training, we have failed to analyze the situation properly, and we have, without proper definition, precipitated an aim and then worked on it for 20 or 30 years. We know by the various religious denominations that this kind of thing has happened all over the world. We've seen the heretics burned at the stake for precipitating aims contrary to the aims of established churches. And when they've been required to give them up, for some reason of energy involvement, they haven't done so. We find that when Bruno was burned at the stake, the church asked him for several weeks beforehand to recant and not teach this sort of stuff. All he was teaching was that the center of infinity is anywhere and the perimeter is nowhere. And they didn't like the implications because it said that any center could be an authority for itself. And this made unnecessary any external center, and therefore struck at the roots of authority. That is, at external authority. And the external authorities had piled so much energy into their concept in the 1600 years from the birth of Christ that they did not take kindly to his statement that would overthrow, in effect, all that they had built up in 1600 years. Consequently, when he, who was the recipient of a long line of contra-doctrine, found himself energized to make the statement that he did, although they said, if you will not say this thing, we will not burn you, nevertheless he said, I must say it. Something in him was so energized that he could not shut up. He gave something of a statement about why he couldn't, but what we know is that in fact he didn't, any more than Socrates did. But Socrates had a quite rational ground for preferring to drink the hemlock. He did say that he was 70. He did say that if he went to another town, it was inertic in him to keep talking, and that wherever he went, he would be required to drink the hemlock, and therefore it was more economic now to drink it here. He had his reason for drinking it there rather than going somewhere else. Bruno was a little younger and a little more fiery, and therefore he preferred to burn. It is very important for us to realize that there is nothing in the bottom row, that is in the gross material world, that is not in the top row, the causal spiritual world. But in the transition from the causal into the gross, a contraction has occurred. The fact that you have a finite physical body that you can locate in space means that forces from infinity are centering on your body. Now, this is a very strange concept to realize, as we know today, it's no longer theoretical, that every material particle is simply a condensation of field forces which are in themselves infinite. The field, the magnetic field around a magnet, is in principle infinite. It is only contradicted by other magnets centered elsewhere. And the contradictions of the fields of these magnets allow a degree of liberation from the fields at certain medial lines between them. So we can start from any material point, like our own physical body or from the earth, and we can move away from it infinitely towards the infinite source of this finite point. The rabbis humorously talked of infinity at both ends. One end is the finite gross material body, and the other end is the absolute, the source power, the causal field. The fact that you have a gross material body means that pressures from the infinite are contradicting themselves at the point of your existence. To exist is to be self-contradictory. Now, in Oriental mysticism and European mysticism, we find a very, very simple idea. It is identical in yoga theory as it is in, say, a mystic like Eckhart or Jacob Burman. The idea is a very simple one, that if you scrub out all the accidentals, what you are left with is the essential. Now, the accidentals are all those things that can be changed. Whatever can be changed cannot be considered to be an absolute essential. And all material bodies are changing, therefore they're not essential. And you can imagine physical bodies coming into existence like human babies, and growing up and growing old and then dying and disappearing. Every material body has a beginning in time, persists through time, and then disappears from time. But the background to all this temporal change presupposed is an eternal, that is a non-temporal, field of force. This field of force is the cause of all the modalities that we call the material world. So the material world is simply this field force behaving in a peculiar way. We haven't got a dualistic concept. We have the absolute, the infinite, and it is acting, it is operating. And wherever it operates, the mode of its operation constitutes a being. As soon as it rotates in a given zone, that is a finite being. But the finite being is only the field force of the infinite at that place. So there is no dualism. There is no ultimate disagreement between spirit and matter. Matter is that which spirit posits, namely itself, actually. And spirit is simply matter uncondensed. So if we release matter from its bondage, we get a big bang and a return to the free state. The concept of the nucleus that has appeared in the nuclear bombs is simply the concept of the contraction point or contraction point of infinite forces. If it were not for the existence of the many, many points within the infinite that Bruno postulated, then any given one of those nuclear points exploding, the explosion would go to infinity. Luckily, there are other centers around it that limit the amount of release of energy and the distance to which it can go, because all the other points round about it not exploding absorb the energy from the explosive point. Any particle of matter can be turned into a center of light which then propagates from that center to infinity. And if it were not for an infinity of other points around it, it would propagate forever from that center. Other points not exploding round about reflected back to itself, and thus the whole universe is stopped from disappearing by the non-explosive points around any given nuclear explosion. If we now look at this central septenary, the psychic level, signified by Mercury, the Messiah. Mercury is the Roman, Hermes the Greek, Messiah the Hebrew, Thoth the Egyptian, the Saviour, who, by a mysterious device called language, which means linkage, manages to join the causal level to the gross material effectual level. He does it by the word. Now the word is simply the power that orders. It is the power of the absolute, first rotating and making a perimeter before it contracts onto a point to make the gross material. The circle with the dot in it, used by astronomers to represent the sun, is used by the ancients to represent the psychic world with the body within it. The psyche is like a private field for any given living body. It is a field that more or less confines its activities within a finite zone. The psyche is simply spirit ensphered, spirit rotating and making a sphere for itself. So that within the psyche is the possibility of the self-realization of spirit. So that in the New Testament we find the statement that the spirit of man can search even the deep things of God, and even beyond God as the object of worship. Thus Eckhart says that the Godhead behind God is the non-dual absolute source of God and his worshipper. If we make a division between God and the worshipper, we have separated man and God conceptually. This is really a heresy that needs correction, because in the book of Genesis, when it says that God took the material world, that's our lower septenary, and then breathed into that material world his spirit, man became a living soul. The body merely made him solo, that is, finited by identification, the consciousness, which is spirit. The soul of man is simply the spirit of God encased in a physical body. And the physical body is the point of reference caused by the contraction of spirit upon itself. The spirit contracts and makes a physical center of reference, and then between this finite center of reference and the infinite beyond, there is a zone of turbulation, which is the soul. Because of this precipitation of the gross material particle as the prime concept from which we derive the finite, therefore St. Paul says, first the physical body, and then the spiritual body. So we can say the physical body, the psychic, which is the spiritual encasing the body, and then the spiritual, which is beyond the spirit encased in the body. The body is the condensed reactive center of spirit. The zone round it, orientated and identified with it, is called the soul. And beyond this zone of identification is called spirit. Let's keep hold of this Trinity concept and the causal settling gross, and have a look at a few of the major trunks. We'll start with the magician again, which represents the absolute. This is the absolutely free, and he has four suits of cards on his table, or four symbols. And we said before, these symbols correspond with the belly, the heart and the head, or the cognitive, affective and ideational processes, and the coordinating force resident in the spinal column. So there are four suits: the cognitive or volitional force, the affective or emotional force, the ideational thinking force, and the coordinating force. All these are on his table or plane of manifestation, and he is going to manipulate them. In the psychic field, the same thing comes down, and at the level of soul, it appears that the soul has the same fourfoldness, only he's precipitated into the time, and the only weapon the soul has, because the soul is not yet compacted into a gross material, and therefore cannot be violent. Violence is excess. The soul can only apply itself by soul forces. Now, if we say that the head of the unfallen being is spiritual, the top septenary, the middle septenary is the heart of the unfallen being, and the bottom septenary is the belly of the unfallen being. At the psychic level, the absolute appears as the soul which cannot be violent. It can only apply its forces as an influence by feeling. It cannot be excessive. It can only feel. That is, it is the zone of persuasion by feeling. And therefore the eighth card, the completion of the first octave, is simply the absolute ensouled. And its only weapon there is influence through feeling. The lion in the picture we've said before means the beginning of the generation of time. But by the application of the soul force, that is by feeling, by creating inclinations, and by no other method, the soul can close or open the potentialities of the time. It can improve the temporal situation, create opportunities, or it can close those opportunities and make them as if they did not exist. When this same force of the absolute passes through the psyche into the gross material world, it now is bound by identification to a gross material body. It is now able to apply a force other than by simple inclination. It has a compacted body that it can throw at another body. It can throw this body through the psyches. If we imagine that the psychic level is the field round the gross material level, if we can get hold of the gross material body, we can throw this gross material body through space. And the space can't stop it. So we have the possibility at the gross material level of balance. You can get hold of your gross material fist, you can take it and poke it in somebody's gross material nose. And this can cause a breakdown of the structures. It is balance. If we look at this devil force, we see that the devil is simply the absolute or God at the gross material level. This means that when we contract all our forces of infinity, onto our gross material body and identify with it, in the act of doing so, if the physical body movements are thwarted and we are identified with that physical body, we can become violent. You can see this quite simply in the case of a child. Take a little boy, get hold of that little boy when he's identified with his physical body and pin his arms to his side, and you will find that he will get very red and he will become excessive in his energy expenditure. He might even kick you on the shins if he can. If he's identified with the physical body and you restrain the action of his physical body, then he will tend to manifest violence. And this violence is the mode of action of those beings totally identified with the gross material world. In this devil card we see that the married couple are chained to a block of stone to symbolize the application of gross material forces. Now at the psychic level this could not occur, and it could not occur at the spiritual level. The material bondage of materially identified beings is really excessive, because when a man and woman get married, they do so from feelings and from causal wills. And if they are willing into the material world, they become subject to the law governing that world. And in the world of matter, ruled over by the emperor, there are certain rules called the rules of material property. And if you break these rules, then the emperor sends his representatives, the army and the navy and the air force, or mildly the police, and they proceed to apply physical correction to your physical body action. In the first trial then, counting from above, we get the absolute, which is spirit, utterly free. Then the psyche, confined in the application of its force to persuasion by feeling. And then on the gross material level, the application of gross material pressures, which everybody confesses are diabolic, except the dictators who use them. They think they're rather good. Now in the second trine, we have the high priestess, which represents the sphere of wisdom in the spiritual level, and this is precipitated into the psychic level as the hermit. Now the hermit is that being who is searching through time for the eternal wisdom. And he is doing so by the application of his finited or identified soul. He's using the soul light to find the spiritual light. He's using individual efforts of the psyche to penetrate to the eternal mystery of form. The gross material level is the collection of the form that he finds and the establishment from this form of dogmas. Dogma is simply the gross material formulation which has been made by the hermit. We find historically during the formative periods of great religions a period in which hermits exist, men that go away and meditate on the eternal mysteries, and they write books and they communicate with each other and swap notes and gradually build up around them disciples and monasteries, and then the doctrines formulated by these men are gradually condensed into gross material dogmas. These gross material dogmas are again under the authority of the emperor, who is really the authority over the gross world, and the source of these dogmas in the psychic world is under the authority of the high priest. The high priest, if you like, is controlling the formal aspect on the psychic plane, the emperor is controlling it on the gross material plane, and the absolute, the Godhead, is controlling it on the spiritual plane. As all temporal beings must have a beginning and an end, it follows that every dogmatic formulation must eventually become anachronistic and be destroyed by the forces that transcend that dogma. And owing to the peculiar nature of dogma, the fact that in making a logical form, which is serialized, the serialization of the form excludes from consciousness those things not considered. And it is impossible to consider serially the proper relations of entities which factually exist simultaneously. No amount of serial conversation about these three levels, the causal, the subtle, and the gross, can put those three levels back together again. When Humpty Dumpty falls off the wall, he's on the middle line here, he is between spirit and gross matter. He knows it's a matter of definition whether he falls or not. And in the particular story about the Humpty Dumpty of Lewis Carroll, he becomes very cheeky and says he will make the words mean what he wants them to mean. This means to say that instead of taking the eternal, true forms, he will make these forms mean whatever his individual will wills them to mean. In so doing, he distorts, that is, introduces a second law into their being and precipitates the gross material world, and he falls off his balancing wall into gross material manifestation. In the negative aspect, it's a fall. In the positive aspect, it is the down-going that Nietzsche talks about. In the third card, the Empress at the spiritual level signifies that precipitation at the causal level from the eternal sphere of form into an existential point. She is like the point or jot which at the level of the preceding card is simply the perimeter. The High Priestess is the sphere, like a great translucent sphere, and the
Empress
precipitated center of that sphere and the generation of time. So the time point, which is going to travel like the dot on a TV screen backwards and forwards, is simply a precipitate of the eternal simultaneous form of the Gnostic sphere. This authority in the mother principle of the time process, the material world, at the spiritual level and the psychic level precipitates itself as the wheel of fortune, which again is said to be a woman, and appears that the temporal process arising from the contraction of the eternal wisdom sphere unto a point, this point now moves in the individuated level, and at the psychic level becomes a wheel of fortune. So that the man who understands how this wheel of fortune comes into existence can see in time eternal forms. And if he can see them in their proper order, he can see the inevitableness of certain forms following other forms. Just as a man knows, if he's been living on earth for a few years, that there are four seasons to the year, and he knows when to buy Macintoshes and when to sell them. So a man that understands that this eternal formal sphere has precipitated into a point which moves, and that this moving point has made the time process, which at the psychic level is the wheel of fortune, he can look into the time process and see what there is present and then refer it back to the gnostic sphere. And in so doing, he can see that thing which must emerge next. So he can see that, say, in the first Elizabethan period, certain things are going to be done. People are going to rush about all over the earth, and they're going to discover things, and there is a natural term set by the size of the earth and the size of men and the amount of energy available. After so many years they will have completed that process of running out to the perimeter of the earth, and that then they will have to run back. We're in the period of running back. We dissolved the empire that the first Elizabethans started to build, and we replaced the horizontal development that they had with a vertical development in an ethical dictatorship. At the psychic level then, the empress or precipitation of time from the eternal form sphere appears as the sequence of events. Precipitation of time from the eternal form sphere appears as the sequence of events. The seasons. And therefore on this wheel we see the word Torah, which means rota and law, and we see a definite order of events in the wheel. We can see four angels round it. There is a man, an eagle, a lion and a bull. The eagle signifies the high-flying intellect, the lion your heart or courage, and the bull your capacity for work at the earth level, and the man is the coordinator for these forces. Which means that there is a time for material work, a time when material work won't do and what you need is courage, and a time when neither of these will do and what you really need is an intellect that can comprehend the formal content of the situation. And there is a time for the coordination of these three. The Wheel of Fortune tells you that if you analyze very carefully where you are up to, you will see whether it's a time for intellectual activity, affective activity, or volitional material activity, or two of them, or three of them. It will tell you whether it's time to lash out and be irrational. It will tell you whether lashing out irrationally is unprofitable. So that the precipitation from the eternal sphere into the time at the psychic level becomes the sphere of the wheel of fortune, and to recognize the order of time to be no more than the order of the eternal, to see the logical necessary development of things, to see how the 17th